this is the globe of Mars made of a mosaic of Mariner 9 images, and there is the Christie Basin filled with the lava flow called Christie Planitia. Here are those rivers flowing into it to the southeast. Here's the ones flowing in from the west. And there was where they originally intended to land. They finally picked a landing site right there, only to then have that one thrown away for a completely different reason, namely radar observations made from Earth. We have got to the point where we can bounce radar beams off the surface of Mars, even 200 million miles away, with enough accuracy to make maps of the planet. And one of the things you can find out is the average roughness of the surface area in a given region on Mars, not where the individual rocks are, but at least the fraction of the surface that is taken up with rocks. And although this looks perfectly smooth in the orbiter photographs, which could show you anything down to, say, the size of a football stadium, it didn't look at all smooth at radar wavelengths. Well, the engineers were very, very worried about that. The landers, if they came down on a rock, all you need is one rock 8 inches high, and that is it for that lander. So they were horrified because they realized they had to start the whole search all over again. And rather than go through that whole story, which was really quite a saga, I'll just tell you the answer to it, namely that they finally landed off the downstream end of one of the western channels, and in fact, where they finally targeted was right there. Here is a picture that you've already seen the leftmost part of before. Remember that picture of the downstream end of the western channels, and I showed you the water gap there? Okay, here you see we are out on the lava of Christie Planitia. There is a region the size of Massachusetts, all of which had to be safe because there was no guarantee that they might not, that they would come down. All they could say was they come down somewhere within this area. There was a 90% chance they'd come down inside this curve, 50% chance they'd come down inside this curve. Well, as it turned out, the engineers had built it better than they knew. Where they came down was right there. But there was no way to know that ahead of time. And part of it, you see, is not the uncertainty about the spacecraft performance itself, which was actually pretty well known. Part of it was nobody knew how much wind they would run into on the way down on the parachutes. And so even if we go back, we're probably going to have to use a landing target region almost this big. The Vikings are unmanned. There is no astronaut on them. I should say wild, because first it scans a line, then the camera rotates a little bit like a turret, scan another line, camera rotates, and all that takes time. It can take as much as half an hour to finish making a picture. And that means that if there is some sort of motion going on during that half hour, well, you may or may not be able to detect it. That is a very interesting point. And let me first show you a picture taken on Earth, just for comparison. This was made overlooking the Martha Marietta plant where the landers were made in Denver, Colorado. And now let me show you a picture that was taken at Great Sand Dunes National Monument in Colorado, which was thought to be perhaps a somewhat Martian-like terrain. Black and white picture, obviously, but taken with the same camera. And these guys are the lander imaging team. For example, the man who is crouched down in the foreground there is Tim Mush, Dr. Thomas A. Mush of Brown University, who was the leader of the lander imaging team. And this guy who is crouched down there is also Tim Mush. And this guy is Tim Mush. And this guy is Tim Mush. And so is that one, and so forth. And in fact, all the other people in the picture were moving around the same way. There are only half a dozen individual guys in that picture. But what they did was, each one, as the camera scanned past him, ran around to a place where it scanned past him again. And so each one got an image model. And of course, the really interesting cases are the split personalities, like this one here, who moved while the camera was scanning them. Well, you may feel that this kind of thing is too much Tim Mush. But the point that I'm trying to show you is that you have a sort of motion detection capability with the lander cameras. If you know ahead of time what the object looks like when it isn't moving, then you can show, especially if you get something like that, that it has moved. Of course, if you don't know ahead of time what it looks like, if the only image you have is taken while it was moving, you may be in big trouble. And so during the same test, Carl Sagan, who else, put a turtle in the field of view of the camera, and while the camera was scanning across him, About three quarters of the way through, the turtle, for reasons best known to his own reptilian mind, decided to get up and take a walk. Here's the result. Here is friend turtle while stationary. Ignore that, it's electronic noise. This is the point where he's decided to move, and here he is walking at about the same rate and direction as the camera itself is scanning. If you got an image like that showing up from Mars and no other image of the same object, you might never be able to figure out what you had seen. So far, it hasn't mattered one way or the other, because so far there has been no evidence for any change, biological or otherwise, in any of the lander pictures. However, that might change. One thing Sagan was very interested in doing was looking in the pictures to try to see anything that might look as though it were alive. Most people who have thought in terms of life on Mars have assumed that it would be entirely microscopic for reasons that I'll go into in the final two lectures. But Sagan says it's a possibility that nature might have been able to evolve macrobes, things big enough to be seen in the cameras, and he looked hard for them, and he says that he has seen absolutely nothing that possibly could be, nor any kind of motion that possibly could be due to life. Of course, that doesn't prove there are no macrobes on Mars. Those pictures show a total of maybe 2 millionths of the surface area of the planet. But nevertheless, for what it's worth, that was the story. So far, it hasn't mattered whether they were snapshots or not. It might at some time in the future. Well, we are about to land on Mars. I'm about to show you, in fact, the very first picture ever taken of the surface of Mars. It is also exactly 9:30, which was the point where I was supposed to cut off. And so this is a good dramatic point to end lecture number one, and I invite you all back next time. And of course, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you very much. To come out on time. I think this is the first time in history that's ever happened, but nevertheless, here we are, we're at Mirabile Dictu. Now, the next lecture will be geology again, except this time geology from the surface, plus Viking Lander 2, and how the landing site there was chosen. Most of that story you already know. So lots of goodies and various diversities, and we'll also talk about the studies of the moons of Mars. But right now, if people have questions, I'll be more than happy to try to answer them. After all that, I wouldn't blame you for having one or two questions. Question here?
Who funds you?
Who funds me? Cranbrook Institute of Science. Right now?
All Senator Trill to California.
Oh.
Did you get access to the
National Public Radio paid me for the individual pieces which I broadcast. As it turned out, they took a large number of them, and so as it turned out, I made a profit on the trip even after you count the money that I had to spend for an apartment out there. Obviously, I couldn't stay in a motel for 3 months, and gas and oil and so forth out there. I made a modest profit on that if you ignore the little detail of buying a car in order to get there, you see. And if you don't count that, it was a net loss. But I would have done anything, short of robbing a bank, and if I'd had a 60% chance of getting away with that, I might have attempted to be there for Viking. I mean, I just couldn't picture, not if it was humanly possible for me to do it. Basically, what I'm doing is trying to make my living by astronomy popularization, and maybe it'll turn out to be possible, and maybe it won't. So far, lots of people have asked me to give lectures about all kinds of things, Cranbrook being an example, and there have been many others, but every single one of them this year has been about Viking. Now, what I'm hoping is to impress on each of these audiences the idea that there are other things that I can talk about and be interesting too. And of course, I have given a lecture here at Cranbrook about Jupiter and the outer planets, which in many ways are even more incredible than Mars. And, there's lots more to be said. Well, I thank you for saying that. As long as you did, and honest, I didn't plan him, that was generous. As long as you did, I'd be more than happy to come back and give lots of lectures on other things. Question over there.
Yes, with the great wind velocity that you described on Mars, isn't there a probability that the spacecrafts themselves, the landers, could actually be destroyed?
Yeah, that's a very common question. I better repeat those questions if you can't hear it in the back. The question is, can the landers survive the wind? That is a very common question, and I'm really happy to see how common a question that is, because it implies that people really care about what those spacecraft are doing up there, how long they will be able to last. And the answer is no. If you've seen a picture of the lander, it's very squat. And in fact, its center of gravity is quite well even within that squat shape. They are designed to survive the wind storms in the sense of not being blown over. Now, the problem is What's going to happen with the sandblasting? We almost certainly will lose some of the meteorology instruments, for example, which are very delicate, fine wires to measure things like wind speed and so on. But, you know, what's going to happen to the camera? Of course, the spacecraft is designed so that when the windstorm begins, it closes its eyes like a turtle, like a lizard, and pulls in its arms like a turtle and wakes up the dust storm. But, you know, what's going to happen when that fine dust gets into some of the moving parts and so forth? There's just no way to know. And, you know, nobody's ever been on Mars during one of those dust storms. Well, as a matter of fact, yes, that's not true. One spacecraft has. I don't know if you're aware that the first successful landing on Mars, at least successful from an engineering point of view, they got down and it survived, was not Viking Lander 1. It was the Soviet spacecraft Mars 3 on December 3rd, 1971. The fifth anniversary of the first successful landing on Mars has already occurred. That spacecraft was launched from Russia 8 months before the landing, and during those 8 months, the greatest windstorm that has ever been seen in the history of Martian observations sprang up. And the Russians, unlike the Viking spacecraft, were committed by their design to a landing on the day they got there. They did not have the capability that we had to wait out any dust storm if there had happened to be one. Now, there shouldn't have been, because we didn't go at the right time of year for a dust storm, but, you know, in case we were wrong about that, we had the capability to wait out that dust storm for as many months in orbit as it took. And, in fact, there was actually serious talk at one point about delaying Viking Lander 2's landing until after conjunction, just because, you know, they had to delay already Lander 1. It wasn't the same thing that was going to happen with Lander 2. They went through it all over again with Lander 2, trying to find a landing site. It was even worse. But the Russians didn't have that capability. They had to land in the middle of that dust storm of 300-mile-an-hour winds. And the incredible fact is that they succeeded. All three of the possible methods of landing on a planet with an atmosphere were used, just as on the Viking landers, and all three succeeded. Heat shields and parachutes and braking rockets. Those parachutes are quite something. For example, the Viking lander parachutes come out at about the speed of sound. And the spacecraft survived. It set itself up on the surface. It erected its antenna. It began to send back data. It began to send back a portion of a television picture. And 20 seconds after the landing, the transmissions cut off and it was never heard from again. And to this day, we just don't know what happened. Possibly, it had a rather spherical shape. It wasn't like the Viking landers with their legs at all. Now, that's a good shape or a bad shape, depending on where you're landing. If you're landing on a planet that's full of soft sand, it's an excellent shape. If you're landing on a planet that is what Mars turns out to be, with all the hard, firm surface and lots of rock, of course, it's a very bad shape. Suppose, for example, that it landed on top of a rock, which we know now from the lander pictures are thickly strewn over even areas on the surface chosen for their safety. You know, what do you suppose the typical areas are going to be like? And they landed at a random location, too. That was the other problem. They didn't have the opportunity to test out and pick a safe landing site the way we did. And so suppose they came down on top of a rock, and then the wind simply blew the spacecraft over. You know, we don't know, and the chances are we never will know, unless perhaps someday, a long time in the future, there is a manned expedition or some sort of expedition to Mars which actually recovers the spacecraft, and, you know, then perhaps we can find out. The moral of the story, though, is that we didn't want to make the same mistake.
Have there been winds that have been registered at anywhere near high velocity?
No, so far, the winds recorded by the Viking Lander's meteorology instruments have been very calm, but that's because the dust storm season hasn't started yet. And Lander 2, well, in the first place, we haven't been there yet in the spring when the cold polar cap is evaporating. Lander 2 isn't far enough north to be getting those winds anyway. But Lander 2 should be in the very depth of the Martian winter, which will be about May 30th, Earth date. It should be at the very, very edge of the frozen carbon dioxide polar cap. In fact, so close to the edge that according to the calculations, which may or may not be right because it's hard to know what to do with certain variables, they're predicting that it should snow every night, snow air every night, and evaporate again the following day. And so the coldest each day at Lander 2 is just before dawn, and so you may be able to see the snow in early morning pictures. The spacecraft, according to the engineers, is not designed to survive that kind of temperature, but the engineers are so conservative on that kind of thing that none of the scientists are willing to do them. There have been so many things the engineers assured us were absolutely impossible, and, you know, then it turned out it was possible. We literally got 2.5 times as much useful data transmission time from Viking Lander 1, as the engineers had said, was the maximum we could possibly hope for. on the basis of their estimates as to how well the radio system would work and so forth. You know, engineers are just real conservative about that. And you can see why. You know, if a whole bunch of improbable worst cases actually do occur, they don't want to be caught to having predicted some of the work and then it doesn't. But, you know, the chances are that, in fact, we'll be able to see that snow. But that's at the very edge of the cap. The strong winds are further north when there's much more material on it. And perennial, you know, it'll last for the day, you know, and so it evaporates all at once instead of bit by bit each day. So the landers ought to be able to survive a windstorm, and they probably ought to be able to survive, one or two ought to be able to survive the snow cap, and what it is that's finally going to kill them, we don't know. As I say, probably they'll just die slowly, bit by piece. Let's take one from the back there. Sir?
How can one get further background details on the economic analysis that shows the cost-benefit ratio of 1 to 14?
Yeah, more details on that economic stuff. As usual, the news media have done their typical lousy job of publicizing that sort of thing. And to be honest with you, I don't know any source that is reasonably easily available to the general public where you can find that. What you'd have to do would be to simply send away to Chase Econometrics, which did the study, and get the thing, you know, and then probably wade through the whole thing. And unless you're a professional economist, I wish you luck on doing something like that, because I know how it's going to be.
When was it published?
It was published 2 years ago, I believe, and it was by Chase Econometrics, which I think is in Valley Kenwood, Pennsylvania. And the chances are that if you wrote a letter or phoned to NASA, Washington, D.C., that's all the address you need, Attention Public Relations, tell them what you're interested in, ask them for the reference and the address, that they could do the rest for you.
Is there a Russian sterilizer?
Did the Russians sterilize their landing craft? All I can say is the Americans asked them that. There was a long silence, many months, and then finally they came back with a statement which boils down to, oh yeah, guys, we sterilized, no worry, we did, sure, you know, and we've never been able to get any details about it. However, I'll tell you this, there has been no failure of sterilization, okay? The Viking sterilization succeeded, and if the Russians didn't, at least the bacteria haven't been able to make it from all the way down the southern hemisphere where they landed up to where either of the landers is. Because if there were Earth life on Mars, we'd be detecting it very characteristically by the biology instruments, and we haven't. If you've been following the biology instruments, the biology findings in any detail, and if not, don't worry, that's what I'm here to lecture about, you know, for the last two. But if you've been following those, you know that the results have been really enigmatic, really bizarre, but really un-Earth-like. Whether it's biology or pure chemistry, it is very un-Earth-like. And so at least that's one worry that we don't have. There were people, you know, who had their doubts about whether the Viking sterilization would succeed. There are a few bacteria which under really improbable circumstances could have survived the sterilization. They're not common, you know, but in principle it could have happened. The design did not say there should be no chance that Earth-like is carried to Mars, that's not possible. What the design said was the chance should be under 1 in 1,000,000, and it's estimated that it was. The International Treaty about Sterilization of Mars said that for 50 years after the date of signature of the treaty, which was only a few years ago, there must be less than one chance in 10,000 of a contamination of Mars with Earth-like, which means that for a single mission, should be something like one chance in 100,000. The Viking people played it safe and made it 1 in 1,000,000. And they seem to have succeeded. Let's take one from down there, yeah.
Yeah, I have a question about the orbiters now. First of all, what would be the probable cause of their demise? How much of the surface has been photographically covered, and to what degree?
Okay, questions about the orbiters. First of all, what would kill them? Second, how much of the cover of the surface has been photographically covered, and third, to what degree? And of course, those two have to be answered simultaneously. Let's answer that last one first, in fact. Mariner 9 was the mapping mission. The Viking orbiters are not, because Mariner 9 did it so well. So to do a mapping mission, what you do is you take reasonably wide-angle pictures of the whole planet. And Mariner 9 took 7,000 pictures, which together covered 100% of the planet, basically. Now, there were a few places where the ground was hidden by a local dust storm or something like that. But essentially, 100% of the planet, with a detail level, with a resolution, which means the level of the finest detail that you can see, of the order of a mile, okay? And in addition, Mariner 9 covered about 2 or 3% of the planet with a resolution of the order of 300 feet. the Vikings will cover maybe 10, 15, 20% of the planet with a resolution of the order of 300 feet. In other words, be able to see something the size of a football stadium, just barely. The Viking cameras are not wide-angle cameras. They are not for mapping purposes. You can fake it by taking a picture from far out in the orbit, and a few pictures like that have been taken. I showed you a few. But most of the pictures are taken really close in for detail. Here's Mariner 9. It does a perfect job of mapping the planet. That doesn't have to be repeated. And so let's look in more detail at areas that Mariner 9 identified for us as being interesting. And that's what they did. That's what they're doing with the Viking orbiters. Now, so what will kill the orbiters? Well, barring some catastrophic failure of an essential system, for example, a power system, for which there is no reason to believe that it's going to happen. Of course, it could happen any time without warning, I suppose, but you know, there's certainly no indication that something is wrong. You don't have to worry about the power source as you do in principle with the landers. The landers have nuclear power sources, but those are so long-lived that nobody believes that's going to be the limiting item even on the landers. However, the orbiters are solar-powered, and so until the sun runs down, the orbiters are okay as far as power goes. But the orbiters have a problem the landers don't, namely that they are floating in free space, and they have got to keep themselves oriented correctly in space at all times. Solar panels must be pointed at the sun, the antenna must be pointed at Earth, the cameras must be pointed at Mars. And in order to do those orientation changes, there is a system of little gas jets which simply fire very tiny rockets and correct any changes that have to be made, or make changes that you want to make deliberately. And so, for example, the orbiters' orbits are being changed every once in a while for one reason or another, and you use up gas in that. This is also a very common question, that is, how long are the spacecraft going to last? And again, you know, it makes me really happy to see that. And so I asked Cal Broom, who is the Viking mission director, once around the turn of the year when I talked to him on the phone, and got a progress report, you know, what are the Vikings doing now? And he just went through a whole lot of things, you know, and finally decided there's just no way to predict it. But one limit, I suppose, could be the supply of gas and the attitude control jets. And with any sort of reasonably conservative picture as to how they're going to use that gas and the orbital changes they still want to make and so forth and so on, we certainly ought to be able to go at least a year beyond the point when the funds are currently scheduled to run out entirely, which is May of 1978. And so we ought to be able to get through 79 anyway. And by being stingy with the gas jets on one orbiter and not making all the changes you'd like to be able to make and so forth, it may be possible to keep one of them alive and therefore maintain a photographic patrol of Mars right through to 1981, which is a date that is often mentioned for a possible follow-on Viking mission. I don't know if you're aware that we have, in storage, bought and paid for a complete Viking orbiter and lander, which are ready to go. Well, I mean, they have to be tested out, and you want to modify them anyway to take account of the things that you've already learned. But they could be flown, say, a couple of years after the word is given. And there is a certain amount, actually, of public and congressional sentiment for a follow-on Viking mission. You would want to equip the rover with wheels or caterpillar treads. One thing that's become very obvious is that the obvious candidate for a follow-on Viking mission is a rover, something you can move around on the surface. And so you land in a place, a safe place, like the one where Lander 1 touched down, and then you start trucking off for those river valleys. You know, you go up one of the river valleys. Or you go down into Volvox Marineris and see what it looks like from the bottom. Or you climb Olympus Mons. Or you go wandering around the polar ice cap. You know, something of that sort. We wouldn't be able to do all of those, but they give you examples of the kind of tantalizing possibilities that exist. But we could mount, you'd think it would take a major redesign from the bottom up, you know, to put wheels on the rover, on the lander. It turns out it takes almost none. And that I was assured by Jim Martin himself, and he was the project director back during, project manager back during most of Viking. Cal Broom has just taken over. And, you know, I just couldn't believe it, but he said it is so, and detailed studies have been done with that. You could make those modifications, fly the spacecraft, and at most, it would increase the total Viking budget by 15%. I have no idea whether or not it will be done. We've had chances like that before and thrown them away. We could have had another entire Skylab mission. Skylab, the most successful space mission that's ever been flown, discovered enough oil and minerals alone, it's estimated, to pay for the entire U.S. space program from beginning in 1958 through the present. Just one small aspect of one mission. And we had another entire Skylab space station and the Saturn V rocket to launch it, and the three command service modules to send three crews of astronauts up to it, and the Saturn 1Bs to launch them, all bought and paid for in storage, was thrown away. It would have increased the total Skylab budget by at most 20%, and it would have, conservatively quadrupled the data, much more than doubled, because you always get more the second time around. If you weren't the first time, what mistakes to avoid, you know? And, of course, Apollo, throwing away the last three Apollo missions, another good example. So I think what it all depends on is the answer to a question about which very little is known. Is there intelligent life in Washington? There are people who think they have seen indications which can be so interpreted, but there are other people who think it can all be explained in terms of chemistry. Will you just come here? Okay, when will the great dust storm start and will they get warnings? The answer to the first question is it starts just after perihelion, the moment when Mars is closest to the Sun. Next perihelion is April 30th, okay? And so it should be through May, sometime in May and June that it should be running. And yes, they will definitely get warnings. Believe me, the planet is going to be photographed very carefully from high altitude, in fact. This is an example of the faking the mapping coverage that I was talking about. In order to see the first hint of the dust storm. Also, of course, the wind sensors ought to pick it up. We don't know how sudden the onset of the dust storm is, but surely we'll get some warning. The wind sensors on the landers. So, yeah, presumably. Yeah. I'm sorry? How much wind? What's the maximum speed before the wind sensor gives way? I don't know how to answer that, because what destroys it isn't the wind itself, it's a little sand grain that the wind blows into the sensor. And, you'd have to tell me the size of the sand grain, how hard it's to hit, and so on, and then I'd have to admit I don't know the answer, because, there's a table of that around somewhere, I'm sure, but I'm certainly not had it memorized. The meteorology people tell me they expect to lose their wind sensor during a dust storm. So that's probably, the significant answer to your question. You had another question back there, Paula.
Yeah, I've heard the largest
volcano on Mars called go ahead. Olympus Mons, yes. There was an old nomenclature of Mars based on telescopic observations from Earth, which cannot see topographic features, that is to say, things that are high, things that are low, mountains, valleys, craters, plains. What you can see there is albedo features, that is, things that are bright versus things that are dark. We do not know why it is that some regions on Mars are brighter and some are darker. Once upon a time, it was believed the dark regions were vegetation. We now know that is not true, and so we've advanced to the point where we don't know what it's about. But the funny thing is that the albedo regions seem to have almost nothing to do with the topographic features. That is, where it's bright and where it's dark seems to have very little relation with where it's high and where it's low, where it's mountainous, where it is, and so forth. It's almost as though you had a relief relief globe, say, of Mars, with all the craters and valleys and so on shown, and some kid came along and spray-painted it at random with dark paint. It's really a very strange thing. It's one of the many Martian mysteries. Perhaps someday we may find out the answer from the Viking landers. Maybe not. But it'd be nice if one of them landed in a dark area and one of them landed in a bright area, but that isn't the way it happened, as it turned out. So the old nomenclature was based on what you can see from Earth, which is albedo features, including a lot of what you cannot see from Earth. For example, the canals, which turn out to be non-existent. They're optical illusions. And when you get to Mars and close up and photograph it and map it in detail, you find it becomes very hard to apply the old nomenclature. You're just not quite sure where some particular region that was supposedly visible through telescopes from Earth was. You get there and it breaks up into three features that are separated by some great distance, and what do you really still call that by the same name? So what they did was they developed a new system which doesn't, in principle, replace the old one. You can still use the old names if you want, but it's a system of names for topographic features. And one of those names is Olympus Mons, which means Mount Olympus, simply. Those names were deliberately chosen to preserve as much as possible of the old albedo system as possible, because after all, it had a lot of poetry in it. It was based on classical mythology and all kinds of good things. It was way back in the days when even astronomers knew their classical studies. And so Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was one of the great students of Mars in the late 1800s, granted he discovered the canals, but he did a lot of other things that turned out to be very valuable as well. In fact, this is 1877 was the year. This is the 100th anniversary of the discovery both of the canals and of the moons of Mars. Canals turned out not to be real. The moons are very, very real. That is because they were discovered by a former University of Michigan student, and the canals were not. He was appalled and studied astronomy at the University of Michigan, and he discovered the moons of Mars in August 1877, so, you know, no doubt that date for a party. Well, anyway, the topographic feature, Olympus Mons, is to be found within the albedo feature, Nyx Olympica. All right? Nobody uses the name Nyx Olympica anymore, really, but in principle it has been thrown away. Nyx Olympica means snows of Olympus, and the reason for it is that there are so often those clouds around the mountain, generated, of course, by the mountain itself. You know, wind goes up, it's cooled by the, it's expanded, therefore cooled by the mountain, stuff condenses out of it. The usual thing, orographic clouds, you get them on Earth as well around mountains. And he named it Nyx Olympica because it was so often bright, it seemed, from Earth. It has nothing to do with the name Nixon, as so many people thought back, you know, in our 9 days when it was being discovered that this feature, Nyx Olympica, in fact, contained this great big mountain. So saying, is it Olympus Mons or Nyx Olympica is sort of like saying, are we in Bloomfield Hills or Michigan? You know, the answer is both. Depends on your level of terminology. Yeah? Yes, that's true. Yeah, there's still a few pictures in Mariner 9 that were not transmitted, and in principle, if somebody went to the spacecraft, the tape could be recovered. Because the spacecraft... Okay, look, you're talking about maybe a dozen pictures out of 7,000, so don't take this as a major failure. At some point, the spacecraft was going to die, right? Well, it happened to die at a time when it had taken but not yet transmitted a bunch of pictures. What killed it, in fact, was running out of attitude control gas. And there was a case where the engineers were so certain that it would never last that long, you know, they had to worry about attitude control gas, that they did not perform, in order to save money, they were forced not to perform, but they weren't worried about it because they thought it didn't matter, a very simple additional little Phillips design, which could have given them much, much more attitude control gas than in fact they had. There's a big gas tank for another purpose elsewhere in the spacecraft, which could have been hooked up with the attitude control system. And if that had been done, we probably would have gotten years more service out of Mariner 9. But as it was, Mariner 9 was a wonderful, wonderful spacecraft, which literally taught us 80% of what we knew about Mars before the Vikings, single-handed. And, you know, it's just a fine thing. The fact that it could have been even more is not to be taken as any sort of criticism of it and the people who built it and the people who flew it, all of which were just a magnificent job. Yeah.
Terrific success of the orbital spacecraft around the moon and around Mars, and then the large orbit, the elliptical orbit around the sun, which got Venus and Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Why have we just flown by Jupiter?
Well, we just flew by Venus and Mercury, too. A flyby question is why we just flown by Jupiter instead of orbiting it. Someday we hope to orbit Jupiter. There are tentative plans for a Jupiter orbiter and probe mission, in fact, a probe to go into the atmosphere of Jupiter in the early 1980s, maybe 81, 82. And, you know, maybe they'll do it, maybe they won't get funding. But it's easier to do a flyby first. Besides, if we tried to orbit Jupiter knowing as little as we knew about the radiation belt and how unexpectedly intense it turned out to be, we said we would have lost the orbit. You know, we didn't orbit Mars until we had had a number of flyby probes investigating the environment in simpler, easier, and therefore cheaper ways first. And the same thing was true with the moon. We'd had, well, not so much flybys as impacts on the moon. Flybys too, actually, but none of the flybys. Those were the days where very often spacecraft failed, you know. Today, only very occasionally spacecraft fail. And it happened, none of the lunar flybys ever really amounted to much, with the exception of the very, very first one, Luna 3, way back in 1959, which sent us the first very crude but still historically important photograph of the far side. And it shows that there, in fact, we know Mario on the far side, which is still one of the big surprises about the moon. Sir?
Why did some of the craters have great
white the craters have raised peaks in the center. Okay, that's a long, involved story. I haven't really told you how craters form, but basically, it's a big explosion. The sound wave of the explosion traveling through the ground bulldozes material ahead of it as it goes, all right? And, of course, as it goes out in all directions from the center, it weakens as it is diluted. And so there comes a certain distance away from the center at which it can suddenly no longer bulldoze solid rock, and there it leaves the rock piled up. And you will note that a crater is not just a hole in the ground. It's a hole in the ground surrounded by a raised rim of material. In fact, the volume of which is just about the amount equal to fill up the hole. Not exactly, because there's a certain amount of stuff that is thrown out. But most of it is simply bulldozed out into the raised ring wall. All right. A certain fraction of the shock wave travels on outward still, but a certain fraction of it is reflected off this suddenly created obstacle, converges back in the center, and brings up the center to form a central peak. You get central peaks only in a certain size range of craters. Too big, you don't get them. Too small, you don't get them. What that size range is depends on the gravitational field of the planet, the surface gravity of the planet. This was the first big study, the first big finding, I think, from comparative planetology. We have learned that fact that I just told you. And so on the moon, the size where the gravity is 1/6 that of the Earth, the size range where you get central peaks is from about 15 miles across up to about 80 miles across. On Mars and Mercury, where the gravity is twice as strong as on the moon, divide each of those numbers by 2. On Earth, where the gravity is 6 times as strong as on the moon, divide each of those numbers by 6, and so forth. Okay? Here's a good analogy. The forces involved in one of these gigantic explosions are so huge that you must not assume that rock has any strength until the explosion is over, okay, until the crater formation is over, which is probably several minutes for the larger. All right. So in order to model it in the laboratory on the Earth, you mustn't use rock. You must use something that has no strength even under ordinary size forces, for example, water. All right. So take a drop of water and put it into a pan of water, and it falls in, and as you know, it makes a little crater, and in fact, a little central peak. Okay? Now the problem is, the water goes on having zero strength even after the forces are dissipated. So what you've got to imagine is to model the fact that the forces are dissipating so rapidly, and all of a sudden you get to the point where the fact that the rock does have strength cannot be ignored anymore. You've got to imagine that you made your crater and then suddenly quick froze it at a certain point in your water. Okay? Well, apparently what happens is, for craters that are too small, the central peak hasn't even had a chance to form yet before you get to the point where you have to freeze it, because the forces are relatively small and dissipate, you know, more rapidly. For craters in a certain size range, you freeze it while the central peak exists. And for craters above that size range, you've got to wait until the whole time the central peak has formed and collapsed back down. That's the best analogy I can give you without a half-hour lecture on crater mechanics. Anybody else? Yeah?
Do they predict any meteor showers on Mars which might be dangerous to the craft?
It's an interesting thought. Are meteor showers predicted for Mars which might be dangerous? I don't think you can predict meteor showers for Mars. I don't see how we could. Because we wouldn't know the orbit of the bodies which are, you know, unless it happens to intersect both the orbit of the Earth and the orbit of Mars, so it gives us a meteor shower and Mars as well, of which there are a few cases like that. I know of a meteor shower on Earth which also occurs from the same bodies at a different time of the year on Venus. But, you know, most of them we just wouldn't know about. And so I guess there's no way to predict that. Now, I wouldn't worry about meteorites actually hitting the spacecraft. Bear in mind, Mars has a thin atmosphere, but in the first place it would burn up the very small meteoroids. And anyway, there they were, stark naked out in an unprotected space for almost a year on the way to Mars, and they weren't bothered by meteoroids. Meteoroids are very, very few and far between in space. They're not anything like the danger that they were once thought to be back before we'd gone into space. Once thought to be by some people. The experts knew better, even then. You know, because we knew roughly how many there were in space. We were just observing the ones we could see from Earth. Okay, yeah.
Wind velocities are high and the erosion, because of the speed that the wind carries, is very rapid.
Right.
But
the wind velocities are periodically high.
Right. Occasionally.
Yeah.
The wind pressure, though, must be rather low because the density is so low.
Because the density is so low.
The sail effect on a lander shouldn't amount to
right. The way you no, the sail effect will not be very much. The pressure, which is what you're talking about there, goes as the square root of the density of the atmosphere. And so, since Mars's atmosphere is about a hundredth as intense as the Earth's, actually not quite that, it's going to be about a tenth as great the effect in the same wind. So a 300-mile-an-hour wind on Mars is like a 30-mile-an-hour wind on Earth. Now, you know, you could have a spacecraft designed so that a 30-mile-an-hour wind on Earth would give you quite a sail effect, but these are carefully designed so that it won't do that. However, that's the pressure. Now, if you're worried about sandblasting, if you're hit by a dust grain at 300 miles an hour, it does the same damage no matter what wind was pushing. The question you've got to ask to scale that is, how many dust grains are going to get picked up by a given Martian wind as compared to a given Earth wind? That gets into all kinds of complications about viscosity of the air and the nature of the dust grains themselves and so forth. We just don't know how to scale that one. And that's why nobody knows how to predict the sandblasting that the winders will get. We'll find out, though. We'll get those data. We'll have it in a few months, as a matter of fact. Okay, let's take one more question. Well, we got two more hands raised. All right, let's take two more questions because we got to cut this off sometime. Man.
Okay, how much information do you
have
about the two moons?
Two moons? Quite a lot, and I'll talk about it in the next program. Yes?
Do you know what the operating budget was for the space program last year, and if President Carter had any
intentions of raising it? The NASA budget, which is only about two-thirds space, was $3.3 billion last year, I believe. And as far as President Carter goes, I have been trying and trying and trying to find out, and absolutely nobody knows what his space opinions are. I have literally asked everybody from Carl Sagan to NASA PR people to people in National Public Radio that might know, and you know, nobody knows. So of course people have that complaint about in other areas too. I asked one guy, and he told me the following story, which may or may not be relevant. Once upon a time, when Jimmy Carter was very small, he came into the living room and his father said, "Jimmy, I want you to tell me the truth. Did you or did you not cut down the pecan tree with your little hatchet?" This is George's day, the pecan tree on a chair. And Jimmy said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't." I don't know. So we're just going to have to wait and see. And particularly, we're going to have to wait and see whether... You know, I don't think there's much danger that he's going to kill the space program entirely, although I've got to admit, I was not exactly overjoyed when he picked for his vice president one of the two leading opponents of the space shuttle, which is the space program, and is a key to our whole future in space, you know, for starting in 1980, just going on. One of the two leading opponents of the space shuttle in the Senate, the other being Proxmire, of course, for the whole time that it was in the formative period. You know, on the other hand, one of his other vice presidential choices was a former astronaut, you know, John Glenn. Now, the one that got it didn't have to be the astronaut, but I suppose what that proves is that Carter doesn't see the variable the same way I do. Didn't make a choice in that consideration. Wouldn't it be more practical to put the Saturn rockets in the use rather than store them? See, what's more practical and what's actually being done are two separate things. It costs less to store them.
Oh, it does.
It does. Oh, yeah. It does, particularly since if you're absolutely certain they're not going to be used, you can track. So far, that hasn't been done, but, you know, one of these days, one of them will end up in the Smithsonian, and the other, what is it, two, I think there are three altogether in storage, you know, will get quietly scrapped somewhere. But, you know, they will be obsolete as soon as we've got the spaceship. There's no question about that. I think it's a shame we couldn't have flown another Skylab in the meanwhile, but, you know, or before that, use them for a roof. On the other hand, the Russians spend more on space every year. They had five times as many launches as we did last year, and they're increasing and we're decreasing. They're doing quite a lot. It's just that as you do, our news media don't tell you about it. You're amazed what the Russians are doing. Freely, I admit, the Russians' technology is not anything like as good as ours. It's good. Anybody can land on Venus. I'm not going to sneer at them. You know, it's not as good as ours, but they're not doing as much as we do, granted. But all we know about Venus is from
Most of them already know about Mars.
It's true. Mars is a great planet. Okay, that's a good point. I wish to wish you a very good night, and I certainly hope you make it through the snowstorm, and I hope I do too. If so, see you next week. I think the last week I certainly can hardly blame you. However, I made it, believe it or not. I was late, of course, but I made it. And some other people did too. In fact, a rather surprising number of other people who did give the lecture. I will try hard to make it as understandable as possible for those that weren't here last week. But I don't know, I don't know the extent to which I can do it. I mean, I'll try as best I can. The problem with this material is that it is kind of interconnected. And you just can't, talk about everything every week and still restrict yourself to an hour and a half. But, where possible, I'll attempt at least to indicate that this was something that I talked about last week. And so the reason you understand it is that, not that you're dumb, but that you weren't here last week, which is humane, if nothing else. Well, for those of you who were here last week, you will recall that at the end of our last throwing installment, we were just about to land on Mars. And, in fact, I had shown you how the lander camera operates. And for those who were not here, the lander camera operates by scanning vertically up and down and then slowly rotating and taking as much as half an hour to finish a picture. In other words, it is not a snapshot. So that can be important. So far, it hasn't been, because so far there's no evidence of any motion on Mars anyway at either of the landing sites. However, when the next great dust storm begins, which should be coming up in May or June, why, we expect quite a bit of motion, and of course there's always the possibility of some kind of biological motion as well. I guess, I don't think I talked about the outline of the series last week, and that's something else that I might mention, again, for those who weren't here. The first two lectures, last week and this one, are on Viking geology, broadly interpreting the term. And the middle one is going to be on Viking atmospheric findings, and the last two are going to be on Viking biology, or let's say the findings of the biology instruments, which may or may not be biology at this point, we don't know. The reason for doing it in that order is that if we give you the environment that Martian life, if any, would have to live in first, then you understand a good deal more about it. And so there's a lot that I don't have to say in the biology lecture that I would have had to say otherwise. Also, the reason is that we do not yet know the answer as to whether there's life on Mars. I don't think very many people expected to know the answer this early, and we don't. And I wanted you to understand that there are a lot of things going on Viking that we already know about, many of which are atmospheric and geological. So, without further ado, if we can have the lights off and the first slide on, this is, in fact, the historic first picture ever taken on the surface of Mars. And it was taken literally starting 20 seconds after the first landing. The left-hand edge, remember it always scans from left to right, the left-hand edge was taken 20 seconds after the first landing, and it took about 4 minutes to finish the picture. And I'm not going to say a whole lot about it. Every time I put this slide on, of course, it brings back such tremendous memories, because there I was, at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, having been up literally since 11 o'clock the night before, because the landing sequence was about 5 hours altogether, and I wanted to be there even a little bit ahead of that. And I tell you, you think it was hard to find parking out there at night. You should have been there at JPL on the morning of the first landing. And, to be there after that experience and after the tremendous emotional experience of being through the landing, wondering whether it was going to happen. No one had ever landed on Mars before. The Russians had made 3 attempts, which the spacecraft was destroyed a few seconds before or after the landing, and then finally it came off. And then to gather around the television set and watch the picture come in section by section as it was being transmitted back from the Martian surface 200 million miles away. And, there have been so many more spectacular pictures since then that I suppose this one, in retrospect, is not too impressive anymore. But when it came in, it was just such a tremendous thing, particularly since it was sharper than anybody really expected. And, every time a new rock appeared, everybody goes, "Wow, look at that!" It was quite a thing. To jump ahead here, I'll jump to the next slide and come back and show you what we've seen. This is a diagram of the Viking lander,
and you're taking the picture with this camera here, which is starting down about there. The surface camera, of course, at that time was not extended the way you see it in the picture. It was retracted into a protective housing up there, and it was not, of course, extended until a little more than 8 days after the landing. Well, the camera scanned across the ground like so and ended up with the foot pad on leg number 3. And the reason for doing that was that there was always the possibility that this might be the only picture we ever got back from Mars. After all, the Russians had had the experience of landing spacecraft on Mars only to have them destroyed a few seconds afterwards. And so it was possible that whatever was destroying the spacecraft was something about the surface of Mars. Maybe it was too soft to land in safely, or too rocky, or too, who knows. And if that were so, then close-up of the ground, particularly close-up of the ground which showed the interaction of the foot pad of the spacecraft with the ground, might give you the clue and might tell you what it was that was going wrong, so that at least next time you could try to do better, try to redesign the spacecraft, or try to avoid the danger. Of course, it turned out that wasn't the problem, and so now we're just not quite sure what it was that happened to the Russians, except that, as I mentioned last week, we had the opportunity to select our landing site, and we went through quite a lot to select a safe landing site, and it turns out that, in fact, most of the surface of Mars is not safe landing sites for our Viking. And the same thing is probably true for their Mars spacecraft as well. So the fact that they came down at random on the surface of Mars and had no choice over their landing sites is probably 90% of the reason. Well, back to the picture. Perhaps the most obvious things in it, aside from the rock and the footpath, are the fact that you've got these streaks over here, and you don't have them anywhere else in the picture. And what's happening there is, remember, the camera is scanning from left to right. Well, this is the dust stirred up by the landing, photographed while it was still between the camera and the subject. And by the time the camera had gotten over to about there, the dust had settled, and so we've never seen anything like this shadowing again, except on the very first picture taken by Lander 2, just after it touched down on Mars. So the belief is that, in fact, the explanation just gave you is correct. The foot pad is sitting quite firmly on the surface. You can see it's quite a hard surface, and it's not sinking in at all. There is some dust that has kicked up during the landing, and which you can see down the sides of the foot pad a little bit, especially collected in the pool there in the bottom. But the landing has, in fact, disturbed the surface very little, and actually it should be. The scientists had quite a bit of concern about the lander disturbing the surface where it landed, since it was not capable of moving away from the landing site afterwards. And they were worried about contamination of the surface with the exhaust from the rocket engines. They were worried about blowing away the surface, and they were worried about heating the surface. And so the engineers came up with a very remarkable design for the rocket engine. And again, if I go forward to that next picture, you can see what it is. You can see that each of the engines has a sort of shower head on it instead of the usual single nozzle that you're used to. And what that did was to produce a spray instead of the usual flame, which was so dispersed that it did not disturb the surface more than blowing away about the top millimeter of soil. And it didn't heat the surface that remained by more than 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit. The reason being that almost all of the heat that it did impart to the surface was in part because that top millimeter so that it blew away. As for the chemical contamination, the original idea was to have the rocket engine cut off about 10 feet above the ground and let the spacecraft free fall. And the engineers didn't like to do that for a bunch of reasons. It was done with the surveyors, which were the lunar equivalent of the Vikings. But still, the shock absorbers and those legs are good, but the engineers didn't want to strain them any more than they had to. And finally, somebody came up with the idea of simply using ultra-pure fuel for the engine. And that was tested out and turned out it worked. And so there was no organic contamination of the soil, and that's what the scientists were primarily worried about. Well, back to the picture then. You can see that, in fact, the surface is very little disturbed, even right next to the foot pad. The only other thing that I want to point out to you is this rock right here, which is a ventifact. A ventifact is a kind of rock that you see very often in terrestrial desert areas, and in fact in any terrestrial area where there is not very much water around and there is a lot of wind, and so wind is doing at least local erosion. I mentioned last time that we do not have large-scale landscapes on Earth which are sculptured by wind, but you do get it in the small scale, particularly in desert areas, and also beach areas. You can see ventifacts in large numbers out in the dune areas in western Michigan, and those dunes are left over from the ice ages when the lakes were changing their level very rapidly. Zenithags formed like this. Those flat surfaces are sculptured by the wind. You can see it's sort of like a little pyramid. And in fact, the scientists were very, in the land imaging team, were very, very careful to brief the press ahead of time about how it was likely that little pyramid-shaped stones would be found on the surface of Mars, and they should not be taken as intelligent artifacts. They knew how to handle the press at least a little bit in this day and age. The flat surfaces are caused by the fact that if the winds are from one prevailing direction, which they are on Mars during the only period of the year when the wind is high enough to do any intense sculpturing, and that is during the great dust storms, then whatever side of the rock is facing towards the wind is going to get sandblasted. And so that produces eventually a flat surface. And then, after a long time, some disturbance comes along and turns the rock over, turns it around so a different side is facing the wind, and so you get another side sandblasted, and so on and so forth. If that happens long enough, you get a remarkably artificial-looking little pyramid. Not all rocks take good Zenithag shape, and you can see there are a number of them that are quite irregular in shape in the picture. It depends on the kind of rock, and it depends on how well you can polish it, and of course it depends on how long it's been sitting in a particular position. But in the case of the Martian rocks, most of those rocks have probably been sitting exactly where you see them in exactly the same position for hundreds of thousands to millions of years. That's not as long as the corresponding figure for the moon, which is hundreds of millions of years in many cases. It is, of course, far longer than the corresponding figure for the Earth, where rocks get pushed around all the time, because we've got so much running water on the surface of our planet. Well, here is the historic first color picture ever taken on the surface of Mars, and this is the correct version with the pink sky, not the blue one, which was first released. And I don't blame the Lander imaging team for releasing that. You'd be amazed how tiny an error was all that was necessary to have that sky turn from pink to blue. Tiny an error in the color balance. And of course, the press types like me were breathing down their throats, trying to get out this first picture as quickly as possible. So it's a little unfortunate that they did make that particular error at that particular time. You can't blame them for doing so. But this is the correct version. And the first thing that you notice is something that you knew all along, namely that Mars is a red planet, but nobody had known that Mars was as red as in fact it turns out to be. The reason for the pink sky is that you have red dust in the ground. You can see everything on the ground is indeed red. But mixed with that red dust is colorless, white crystals of frozen water, and in other parts of Mars, frozen carbon dioxide. And so that dilutes the color and makes it pink instead of red. Well, as a result of that, about half of the light that we get from Mars actually is from that pink sky, from the dust in the atmosphere, rather than from the surface. And the reason is there is so much dust in the atmosphere, it's so hazy there, and I gave you examples of that last time. And so no one had realized from Earth-based observations of the global color of all of Mars added together, that in fact the surface was going to turn out to be as unbelievably intensely red as it actually is. And the Lander imaging team had a lot of trouble convincing themselves that this really was the right color balance. And it wasn't until they had done things like photographing the color patches of known, precisely measured color, which were put on the spacecraft for exactly this kind of purpose, that they were confident that, in fact, their cameras were working properly on Mars and their reconstruction equipment was working properly on Earth, and they really were getting the right colors, and it really is as red as it looks. I'll tell you in a few moments why it is that Mars is red. The pink sky on Mars means that Earth is probably the only planet left in the solar system that has a blue sky. All the others either have no air, such as the moon, in which case the sky is black, or else, if they have air, they're totally covered by clouds, and so the sky is the color of the clouds. And that includes Venus, in which the sky would be a pale lemon yellow, Jupiter and Saturn, which would be mostly orange, Uranus and Neptune, which is green, and there's only one other body left in the solar system that has an atmosphere of any size, and that is Titan, the big moon of Saturn, which we know so little about that I can't tell you whether it's covered by clouds or not, and I can't tell you what color the sky would be. So if you want another blue sky planet, Titan is your only other possibility, and that merely by default. Mars' pink sky, I would hardly claim, is the most important Viking discovery, but it was certainly one of the most startling ones, and to the best of my knowledge, no one at all had predicted it. we had thought that Mars was going to have about the same color as the Earth, except very, very much darker, just about black overhead, and maybe a deep blue at the horizon, because we hadn't realized the significance of that dust, and we thought that it was going to be colored by the Rayleigh scattering, that is, the bouncing of sunlight off molecules of the air itself, which is more efficient for blue wavelengths than for anything else, the longer wavelengths. And nobody had realized that dust was going to dominate the Rayleigh scattering, and so there you have that incredible pink sky. Well, this picture is about 60 degrees worth from top to bottom, and so I'm probably the only person in the house who's really seeing it at about the right scale. People who are sitting in the back are probably seeing no more than about 15 degrees worth. And the horizon is about 2 miles away. It's almost exactly 3 kilometers if it were a sea horizon. Most of the fact is actually closer than that. If you look very hard, and it's more obvious in later pictures, you might be able to see that there's a near horizon. There are very low but still noticeable swells across the picture. And then there's a distant horizon that's barely peeking up from behind it. And the distant horizon is rather fuzzy, because by the time you're 2 miles away from the observer on Mars, there is so much dust between you and it that it looks rather like a smoggy day in downtown Los Angeles. That is, the distant objects are not at all clear. If you had mountains sticking up from behind there, the way you do from downtown Los Angeles, chances are they look about the same as they do from downtown Los Angeles, that is, invisible. The house on the hill up here, they gave things names. The house on the hill is the edge of a meteorite crater, the rest of which goes on over to about there at the scale of this picture. And that's a small one. This is in the northern hemisphere of Mars, which is mostly covered by lava and does not have very many craters. But there are a few that have formed in the lava, and there is one of them. Many of these rocks are undoubtedly ejecta, material thrown out from that crater when it formed, and there are two other craters visible on the horizon, plus possibly some others that are farther away on the distant horizon where you can't see. You can see right away that there are a number of different kinds of rocks, some of which you can make good benefactors, a real beauty, and there's a nice benefact, and there are others you can find in the picture. And these rocks, you can see, are dark, and there's a whole line of these dark rocks, sort of blue, black in color, which are running through here. Those are almost certainly basaltic lava, which was known from the orbital photographs to be the dominant bedrock in this particular region, and that great lava sheet, Vespucius Borealis, which covers most of the northern hemisphere of Mars, is in fact dominantly basaltic. But there are other kinds of rocks too. There are these oil-colored ones in the foreground, for example. And in fact, there are at least 5 different kinds of rocks visible in these pictures. And there are other geologists who have gotten more enthusiastic than that. And there's at least one of them who, when forcibly restrained, was claiming at least 40 different kinds of rocks. Now, that's not 40 different chemical compositions. He was talking about any kind of difference that you can see, for example, degree of weathering and so forth. Nevertheless, quite a remarkable figure. And I think the most remarkable fact about the Viking 1 landing site is that this place, which looks so spectacular and has all this variety that you can see within it, right within the same picture, this is a place that was carefully chosen after many, many man-hours of work as one of the most uninteresting places on the surface of Mars, because that was the only place where you could safely land. And so it had to be flat and bland and uninteresting. And if one of the boring places looks like that, what are the interesting places going to look like? And that's just one reason for something that I said to the close last week, that is the obvious follow-on for Viking is the rover mission, perhaps for 1981. The rock and soil layer, the regolith, to use the technical term, which means the rock and soil layer, is mostly thin. There are a few exceptions to that. For example, these hills of piled up soil material, which you'll be able to see better in a later picture where the lighting is more favorable for them. But mostly it's a fairly thin layer, only a few inches thick. And as a matter of fact, there are a number of places where bare naked bedrock actually comes up to the surface. There's one of them, there's another one, and there are some others that you can see that are smaller. There are a lot of different shapes to the rocks, and you can see, especially in the foreground, that a lot of these rocks are full of holes. And those holes are called vesicles. They are a common phenomenon in lavas on Earth, and they are caused by a kind of interesting thing. When the lava is liquid, it has a lot of gas dissolved in it. In fact, as you'll hear next week, that is the origin of the atmospheres on our kind of planet. Gas dissolved in lava, which has come up to the surface by volcanic activity. and it is dissolved there, but as you relieve the pressure in the final few hundred feet of the lava's rush up to the surface, the gas suddenly comes out of solution exactly the same way as it does when you open a can of beer and release the pressure there. And so all of a sudden, a large amount of carbon dioxide escapes from the beer, in this case, water vapor, carbon dioxide, and other things. And then, of course, the lava freezes. So if you imagine solidifying your beer as soon as you've opened the can, which is what happens to lava, you can imagine how you would get some sort of solid, icy block, which would be just full of holes, exactly in the way that the rocks are, for exactly the same reason. And so by studying the number of them that are full of holes versus the number that are not, you can figure out all kinds of neat things. For example, how many of those rocks started out right near the tops of lava flows versus how many of them were further down in the ground, that kind of thing. And if many of these rocks are, in fact, ejected from this crater and the others that are visible, then you can get you can correlate those data with the size of the craters. And if you can measure the diameter of the crater, you know its depth. That's a very well-known relationship by now because craters are so well studied. And so you get information like the depth of the lava flow and all kinds of good stuff. You remember, though, that the reason for landing at this particular site was not particularly to study the lava, which, after all, we had studied in great detail on the moon, but in the hope of getting the water deposits, the river deposits from those great channels. And that has simply turned out to be a false hope. And probably the reason for it was that they were so clever about finding a place where it wasn't flat, in fact, flat and safe, that they found one that was flat for the reason that there had been a later lava flow, a post-channel lava flow, which had covered over the river deposits in this area. And there is, in fact, only one rock in the picture which looks as though it might have been water-carved. I'm not saying it was. I'm saying that the can is the one that might have been. That's the Midas Muffler rock right here, with that rather startling cylindrical shape to it. And when I first saw it, I was convinced that it was a dinosaur's thigh bone, but the official version was that it's a Midas Muffler. And as a matter of fact, this is the Volkswagen rock up on the horizon there, which is about 10 feet long. And so we have apparently the incredible situation that we go 200 million miles from home, land at a random location, at least random within an area the size of the state of Massachusetts, and happen to come down right in the middle of an auto junkyard. That's really pretty incredible. That is great that we did it. This thing over here, which is called the washbowl, may be an especially large vesicle, but more likely it's an example of cavernous weathering, which is a phenomenon that you often see in desert areas on the Earth. That's just a standard way that certain types of rocks react to having lots of sand blown into them, in the same way as other kinds of rocks react by forming flat polished surfaces like Zenithax. And one other thing that I want to point out, and it's especially visible in through here, you can see that a lot of the rocks have little tails. Those are wind tails, very much like ones that I showed you on a very much larger scale on the bottom of Valles Marineris last week. And what happens is, the great dust storms are coming along, blowing dust in the atmosphere. The wind is coming from one particular direction, and in fact it is known from orbital photographs that this is the prevailing direction of the wind during the time of the dust storms on Mars at this particular landing site. And when the air gets into the dead, when the wind gets into the dead air zone behind rocks, it finds that it cannot carry the dust as efficiently because it gets slowed down and the solar is going, the finer particles are allowed to carry, and so it dumps this stuff, and there you see those wind tails as mute evidence for you later on of what the prevailing direction of the wind in fact was. So I think you can see there's lots and lots of scientific studies using these pictures. There's a great deal more to them than simply, gee, look at the pretty picture, it is red, isn't that interesting, and turn on the next page of the paper. The problem, though, with these pictures is that they look so familiar, aside from the red sky, that it's really kind of a mind-wrenching experience to realize how alien that landscape actually is. They look so much like the Arizona desert that you've really got to remind yourself very firmly that the temperature when that picture was taken was like 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. That the air that you are looking through is made almost entirely of carbon dioxide and thinner than the air at the base of the stratosphere on Earth, and that there is no liquid water anywhere on that planet at the present time, at least in quantities more than a drop or so, and that only in the very most specialized places. Most of the planets I mentioned last time cannot have liquid water at all. So don't let the familiarity of the scene blind you to the differences as well. Now, here's the reason that Mars is red, and I'm showing you a sample of the same sort of thing on Earth. What's happened is that we have a seam of red material, which is in fact rust, limonite, natural iron oxide, and they have a stain on the outside of all the rock and all the soil grains. So Mars is not a planet where there are large amounts of rust lying around in chunks all over the surface, as was suggested as one of the theories for the Mars red color before the Vikings landed. It is also not something more exotic like red plastic snow, which was another standard theory. The idea was that ultraviolet radiation from the sun polymerizes the carbon dioxide, which is a major constituent of the Martian atmosphere. Polymerize means you build it up into larger and heavier and more complex molecules, and those are literally plastic. The polymer is a plastic, and I should say a plastic is a polymer, and then the stuff, since it would become a solid, would fall out of the air onto the ground. Well, it was a nice idea, but it turns out not to be true. What it is simply a limonite stain on the outsides of all the rocks. And the proof in this picture that is a stain on the outside, rather than the true color of the rock, is that William Hardman, who took the picture, has selected a rock which has been broken open, and you can see that the inside color of the rock is not red at all. In fact, that is the rhyolite from the lookout, which I don't want to swear to that. In any case, it certainly isn't red. Limonite is an iron oxide, and the way that you get it is, the way that you get this kind of stain on the outside is that this is an example of a phenomenon, again, well known in arid areas on Earth called desert varnish. Desert varnish is not normally limonite on Earth, although it does happen, as in this example in Arizona. The more familiar kind of desert varnish is a blackish one, which is a manganese oxide, and which you see here is an example that I photographed close up of an ancient Indian petroglyph. The Indians came along and they chipped away the desert varnish, which covers the outside surface of this rock, in order to reveal the inside surface and show this picture of apparently a bird eating a toad, although the experts, I understand, are a little bit divided as to what this thing over here is supposed to be. But this particular example was the Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona. You can find them all over the Southwest. In the case of the limonite, what happened was that a liquid water is percolated through the rock, and many rocks are, in fact, capable of having water move slowly through them, even though you think of them as being hard and impermeable. And as it goes through the rock, it dissolves out iron from the iron-bearing mineral. Well, the salt particularly has lots of iron-bearing minerals. In fact, those, when they're not rusted, are the reason the salt is so dry. So when the rock gets to the surface, and it will get, when the water rather gets to the surface, and it will get to the surface because it's evaporating at the surface, because the air in a desert environment is dry, and so as the water evaporates to the surface, it soaks up more water that's still inside the rock by capillarity, and so there's a constant supply of fresh water that's being drawn to the surface of the rock, because that could be replenished from somewhere underneath. But it's constantly being drawn to the surface of the rock, and as it does so, it evaporates, leaves behind the material that's dissolved, including the iron, and at the surface, the iron rusts, so there's even a trace of oxygen in the atmosphere, which there is on Mars. So the point is that you have to have liquid water in small amounts to be sure. This will not happen in a humid climate like Michigan. You never see desert varnish in Michigan, because there is so much water that any such material that's deposited on the rock can simply be washed away. However, in a desert environment, you have it, but you must have liquid water in small amounts in order to produce this. You do not have liquid water on most of Mars at the present time, and so the very fact that Mars is red, the very fact that the ancients chose to name it Mars after the god of war, who reminded them of things like blood and iron and fire, and in fact iron, and other iron swords, rusted. That very fact, the fact that Mars is red, was a hint, now that we realize in retrospect, that the climate on Mars has been very, very different even in the past than it is now. And so, once again, things that I showed you so much evidence for last time, we see evidence for here in the Lander pictures also. This idea that the reason that Mars is red is a limonite desert varnish on all the rocks and soil grains was suggested by some people before the Viking landings, but there were competing theories also, and so Viking confirmed that one was right and the others were wrong, and that's the status of that. Okay, let's run through this one and go on to the next one. These are two pictures that were taken on the surface by Viking Lander 1, and you can see, out of focus, but you can see it, the famous scoop, the surface sample head, in its protective housing still, And this is exactly the same scene. There's the scoop in the same place, and there's this piece of spacecraft in exactly the same place, and there's a particular rock, and there's the same rock. These are exactly the same scene, photographed by the same camera under the same conditions. The only difference was the lighting was different than the two pictures. The sun was coming in from a different height in the sky and from a different direction, and you can see this was totally different. And so now you see one of the two reasons why the scientists are constantly re-photographing the same scenes in the landscape over and over again. It's not just that they have no choice, but it's the only landscape they can see, so they may as well make the best of it. In addition, you want to study it under many different lighting conditions, and you can learn all kinds of things from the one picture that you can from the other, and vice versa. And the other point, of course, is that if there are any changes, the only way you're going to notice them is by taking repeated photographs. Or there's one other possibility, which you can use to notice change on a smaller scale, and that is to take advantage of the fact that the camera doesn't take all the picture at once, as I showed you at the very end last time. Another part of the way, we've got some rocks over here, and we've also got a number of areas where there are not rocks, where it looks sort of like the surface of dirt instead of rocks in between, and those are, in fact, the silt jet. This is a mirror of those hills that I was showing you in the first picture, and I've got a much better picture of them over here. This has got to be the most spectacular picture yet of either of the Viking landers, and I suppose most of you know it because this was the one that Janet used on the front cover of the Cranbrook Bulletin, which told you the collections were going to happen. But it is certainly a very, very spectacular picture. You're seeing the meteorology boom here running through the middle, and that kind of gets in the way, but that's unfortunate. I mean, there it was. And you can see there are lots of rocks on this side, and then there are all these silt drifts over here. And to give you the scale, this is Big Joe, who was about 10 feet long and about 3 feet high. Well, the silt drifts were originally called sand dunes, and in fact, there was a lot of talk about the sand dunes that Lander 1 had photographed right next to itself. And in fact, those are not sand dunes. They're not sand, they're not dunes. Sand is a technical term in geology, and it refers to particles of a particular size, no bigger and no smaller. If they're smaller than that, they're called silt, and that's the size that I've been talking about loosely is dust up to now. The stuff in the atmosphere is silt-sized particles. If they're larger than that, they're called pebbles or cobbles or whatever. And dune is also a technical term. Dunes are hills which are formed only by sand. And the fact that sand is the particular size that it is relevant to the fact that dunes have a particular shape they do. These do not have the sand dune shape, as they're improved to you, by going to some genuine sand dunes, which I photographed in Death Valley National Monument, and you can see they do, in fact, have a different shape, particularly. They've got this characteristic profile of a gentle slope in the direction the wind is coming from and a steep slope on the other side. Because what happens is the wind is blowing the sand along, it gets up over there, gets into a dead air zone, and drops sand. Just the way we saw on Mars on a smaller scale with the dust tails in the leaves of the craters. But this is with sand, and sand drops really hard, unlike dust which floats down, and so you get this particular characteristic shape on the dune. All right, back to the silt drift then. These do not have that shape. As a matter of fact, these are quite severely eroded. And apparently what happened was, these are just like the wind tails that we saw on a much smaller scale in that color picture that I showed you first, except that these are produced by the large boulders. And the reason this is such a spectacular picture, aside from the fact that they were clever and took it at the right light, you know, when you look directly into the sun, you're going to get dramatic shadows. And when the sun is low in the sky, you're going to get dramatic shadows. And when you look directly into the sun when it's low in the sky, you're going to get really dramatic shadows. And that's almost the guaranteed recipe for taking spectacular pictures of any landscape. Well, the sun in this picture is right there. This is the equivalent of 7:15 in the morning, local Martian time. And so it's a very dramatic picture. Well, what happened was, the other reason it's so dramatic is that you've got both the biggest boulders that you can see from Lander 1 and the silt drift all in the same picture. And that is not coincidence. Every one of those silt drifts has formed downwind of a boulder. And remember, we know which way is downwind from the others that I've already given you. And so here is Big Joe, and here is its associated silt drift. But you say, wait a minute, how come in that case the silt drift doesn't go all the way over to Big Joe? And the answer is that apparently at one time, probably millions if not tens of millions of years ago, it did. And ever since then, it has been being eroded away by the wind, at these things here, which look superficially like sand ripples, such as you saw on the surface of the dunes in that picture that I took in Death Valley, are not. They're not the same shape. I'll go back to that picture in a moment and show you that. What these are, in fact, is nothing less than the outcropping edges of strata, of layers within the silt rip. And you don't have that kind of thing unless you've got erosion. Apparently, at some time in the distant past, these drifts were much larger than they are now and did run all the way up to the boulders, and they got cemented into place by something. Again, material left behind by evaporating liquid water. And this is just the first piece of evidence that I've shown you that, in fact, the Martian surface tends to be, at least at both the landing sites, it tends to be very well held down by some cement. The soil grains at the surface are not just lying there loosely waiting for the next dustworm to blow them away. A lot of them are in fact cemented into place. You can dig through that cement. They have no trouble digging holes with the surface sampler, but nevertheless it is there, and in fact I'll show you some chunks of it a little bit later on from Landy too. Well, these silt rifts then are cemented into place, and so the wind is now eroding them away. Once upon a time, the wind deposited them. Now we don't have a depositional environment there. We have an erosional environment. The wind is slowly eating them away, and these are the remnants that you are seeing right now. Once again, therefore, evidence just in these pictures, two different kinds of evidence, that in the distant past, Mars had a different climate than it does now. Evidence number one, the fact that they are cemented, therefore that there was a liquid water which was evaporating. It was still an arid climate. The water was evaporating when it reached the surface. But nevertheless, it was wetter than it is now. And in fact, I've already shown you an example last week of material left behind in arid climate when liquid water evaporates upon reaching the surface. Remember the caliche that I showed you in the high plains in Texas? Well, caliche is an example of an evaporated deposit left behind in that way. The word caliche, in fact, was loosely used in the beginning to refer to the cement on the Martian surface. But caliche is also a technical term. It refers to a particular substance that's supposed to be calcium carbonate, if you call it caliche. Very quickly, the X-ray fluorescence experiments on the Viking landers, the device that would study what the soil itself is made of, discovered they're not made of calcium carbonate, and so the geologists use a more general term, which in fact I think they made up for the purpose. They call it durocrust now. And so I'm just going to call it cement. Anyway, the fact that the cement is there shows that it was liquid water, and also the fact that once upon a time the winds were depositing those drifts, and now they're not depositing material there, they are eroding it, shows you that we have a different climatic regime now than we did then. Now, this is a map which was made of the area immediately around the spacecraft, and here you see the 3 foot pads, and there's 1 meter for scale, and a meter is just a little more than 3 feet. So that's about a yard. And this is the area that the camera can see well enough to make this kind of map. You can see quite a number of things there. For example, the various trenches which they dug for the soil sampling studies, including biology. But I just want to point out one thing to you, and that is that the spacecraft has landed so that literally one foot pad is on one kind of terrain, and another foot pad is not only on but buried in a completely different kind of terrain. And that really is incredible. I was joking about landing in an auto junkyard before. We really did do something just about that unbelievable. We came 200 million miles, touched down under no control as to where we were going to land, at a random location. We only knew it was going to be an area somewhere within an area the size of Massachusetts, and we managed to land literally on a geologic contact. And I claim that is a real gift from the gods. And we can forgive them a lot for example, not allowing the seismometer or lander one to operate, to give us a gift like that. Because what it means, of course, is that you can, and of course they have, studied both the rocky kind of material and the silt rift and the contact they landed on, so that literally one foot pad was on one, the other was in the other. The contact they landed on was the boundary between those two. The first samples were taken of the silt rift because it was material that was easier to dig, but they went out and got the rocky stuff with the durocrust as well. Here is how you dig a hole on Mars. This is a picture of an area that you've already seen, because that picture, remember the two with different lighting, was just about the same place. And here you see the tail end of the silt rift, and then there is the contact, there's the border right there. And here is after the first trench has been dug. Viking dig Mars. You see, I'm not the only frontier around the Viking project. This is the famous surface sand we're photographing against the Martian pink sky, except that it's black and white, so you can't tell that. You can see how bright the sky is. And here is another picture taken with the other camera, so we got some spacecraft components in the way, after a second trench had been dug. And here is a rather rare photograph. It's a little out of focus, but you can see it. The surface sample head is upside down compared there with this photograph, and you'll see that. And it is in the act of dumping soil into the hopper, which feeds the soil. It's one of the three experiments on the Viking lander which study the soil. Those three experiments are the biology package, the gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, which looks for organic chemicals in the soil, and this one, the X-ray fluorescence experiment, XRFE, which studies what the soil itself is made of. The biology experiment itself consists of three sub-experiments, and the fact that there are three experiments, but the biology is three in one, led to endless confusion among the reporters, and I don't think any of them, most of them ever will get straight that they were not correct when they said things like, there are three biology experiments on Viking, one of which works for organic chemicals in the soil. That's not the way it goes at all. That's a completely separate instrument. This is a good time as any to say something about the surface sample, too, which was also widely misreported. You remember that there were a number of occasions on which it failed to operate. And every time the newspapers wrote this up as over the end of the world and some sort of horrible thing had gone wrong and showed the stupidity of the people of Bill Viking and so on, and there was almost never much of a mention of the fact that it then got working again, and so you never heard anything more about it until the next time it failed. Well, as a matter of fact, those were not failures. The instrument was doing precisely what it was supposed to do. Here's the deal. Your spacecraft is 200 million miles away even when it lands, and it was going to get further away than that. And even at a distance of 200 million miles, it takes a radio signal traveling from the Earth to the spacecraft, or vice versa, at the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, 20 minutes, one way. And so if you are trying to operate the spacecraft in real time, for example, you tell it to do one particular thing, you send out the command to have it do one that one particular thing. It is going to be 40 minutes after you sent the command before you know whether it did it right. Well, obviously, you cannot operate a spacecraft in real time when there's a 40-minute delay every time you send the command that way. For example, to dig this particular sequence took about 60 individual commands. Well, you multiply 60 by 40 minutes, and you'll be able to understand what I'm talking about. It was possible to operate the surveyors on the moon in real time, and even to give the astronauts, the humans on the moon, more or less real-time instructions. It is not possible to do that when you're 20 minutes away. And so, the way the spacecraft was designed was that there's a very, very smart computer on board, the smartest one that's ever been flown in any spacecraft, and it has, in fact, a memory of 20,000 words, which is more than an intelligent 8-year-old child. So it's a very clever device. It's not as inventive as a 6-year-old child. If anything goes wrong, it doesn't know what to do. So, you know, the 8-year-old is still smaller overall. But it does have quite a good memory. And so what you do is, when you want to go through a sequence something like this, you send up the entire sequence of commands to the computer. And you go through the usual thing about making you read them back and make sure it's understood them properly and there was no noise in your transmission, all that kind of thing. When you are satisfied the computer does in fact understand how to dig a hole, you send it a final command, which is just called go.